Good evening, Sheffield. Good evening, the world. Welcome to the Landmark.
Hello and welcome to episode 59 of the officially unofficial Def Leppard podcast, Def Leppard. This is also the last episode of season 5 of Def Leppard before we take a little break. Now, for those of you who listened to the previous episode, that was episode 58, where we previewed Def Leppard's 2 Sheffield shows, well, you may well be thinking, wait there, didn't they say that the previous episode was the last of season 5? Well, yes, you would be correct. But now, having been to see Def Leppard in the Leadmill in Sheffield, a last-minute small club gig, and then going on to see the lads at Bramall Lane, Sheffield United Stadium, and in doing so, also kicking off the European tour. Well, to quote Al Pacino in Godfather Part 3, just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in. And Paul, Def Leppard's Sheffield performances have pulled us back into an unavoidable and entirely necessary episode of Def Leppard, haven't they?
Yeah, I don't think if you really rewind to like when you started Def Leppard, don't think you could ever have envisaged that the band would be as current or contemporary in 2023 as they are. And it's just been impossible to ignore because everywhere I've looked, and I haven't had to look that far, like it's not just in my Twitter feed or just in my Facebook feed, there are reviews of this gig. There are discussions about Drastic Symphonies. They're on the radio, which they're never on the radio in the UK. So really, in order to capture kind of the mood of the moment, I figured we just had to come back, didn't we?
Yeah, and it's mad, isn't it? Because even from the last time we spoke, which was obviously that preview episode, even between now and then, even if you take out these 2 shows, you've had the new album, Land, Drastic Symphonies, which I've barely had a chance to listen to. You've had a new book, definitely, which is arrived, but I've barely had a chance to flick through. They did the BBC Two Piano Room performance. They've done a book signing. They've done a HMV signing. There's been multiple interviews coming out, whether it be on Planet Rock or Tim Burgess's podcast from Absolute Radio. There's actually been more stuff coming out than you can keep up with. And even as just we go to record this today, they've just literally released a YouTube video, which is one of their vlogs, where they are showing that week that I've just talked about, where the lead up to the release of Drastic Symphonies. Another one came out that was just about a minute long a couple of days ago, which was a vlog for the HMV sign. And it's just been unbelievable how much stuff has been going on. Can you remember a time like this?
Not in relation to this band. In fact, in terms of trying to think about how I could possibly equate this to something else in my life. And the only thing I can get anywhere near is when I follow a football team, and it's the closest thing I can think of whereby you've got a big match on a Wednesday, then a big match on a Saturday. You know, maybe you've got a big cup run towards the end of a season. And that really is the closest I can possibly come to it. It has simultaneously felt like both the shortest and longest week in the weirdest way, because last Tuesday, what day are we on today? We're recording this on a Thursday. A week last Tuesday was the book launch event in London, and I went to that. And given what you've just laid out, that feels like a mini lifetime ago, but it's 9 days. So no, in answer, I can't ever remember being this bombarded. And it comes back to my point about how ridiculously current and contemporary this 40-year-old band suddenly seem.
So before we get into the 2 shows themselves, I think regardless of whether you're listening to this and you went to no shows, whether you went to 1 show, whether you went to 2 shows, whether you were watching the Leadmill live stream or following what was happening on social media or in a completely different part of the world, or whether you were in Sheffield and you were there for just an afternoon or the weekend or across a week, or whether you even took in London as well, this felt like a real event, didn't it? A Lep Fest, you could say, where every individual Def Leppard fan, whatever way they've experienced this Sheffield experience, they're all going to have their own story to tell. Does that sound right to you, or am I still just drunk?
No, completely. And it just as you were talking there, I thought to myself, also, depending upon how you choose to enjoy Def Leppard, so let's say whether you are someone who likes to attend gigs, whether you're someone who much prefers, you're just someone who listens to records, whether there's certain parts of Def Leppard's discography that you enjoy more, whether you are someone who loves to dig deep into the interviews, or whether actually you're just minded to listen to music, or whether reading a book is something you're into, you sit down, that's where you relax. The point I'm making is there has been something for everyone across this period. So no matter who you are as a personality type, as you listen to this, what Def Leppard have done over the course of this incredibly small period is something for every single type of fan that they might have. I don't think anyone can be left. I'd be amazed if people can come out of this week who consider this band to be either their favourite, one of their favourites, or even if they're a casual fan. Nobody is going to be able to come out this week and say, well, they definitely got that wrong, because they've just, I think, nailed near enough. They'll be tiny, just for the sake of conversation, there's tiny bits you might pick on, but good God, you are a world-class whiner if you're finding fault with these last 9 days.
I'm simultaneously feeling Def Leppard out. Like, part of me is thinking, I just need a break from Def Leppard. But the other part of me, exactly the same time, is like, I feel like I've had one or two days of now of not massively intense Def Leppard interaction. And I've got like Def Leppard cold turkey, and I cannot get enough Def Leppard. So I'm thinking, you know what? It's probably good for your health, Neil, to just, you know, take a little break from a bit of Def Leppard. But I'm whacking Drastic Symphonies on, getting my hands on slightly illicit bootlegs of the Lead Mill show. I'm watching YouTube videos of Bramall Lane. I'm watching YouTube videos. And it's weird. It's like, I need to leave it alone, but I can't. And in a way, coming back to that Godfather quote, it is true. It's just like, kind of like be pulled back in. So I'm just letting myself go now. Right. The Lead Mill. Friday, the 19th of May, right? Me and you met in a pub called the Sheffield Tap, which is by Sheffield Station. What were your excitement levels like going into Sheffield on that Friday night and going to that Lead Mill show?
Yeah, obviously huge. We talked in the preview about how unusual it was going to be to see them in that kind of setting. But a thing that really played into it, it was just kind of the personal aspect of it, because I really had to rush to get to Sheffield. I was working down in London and I had to kind of make this really drastic dart away from the meeting I was doing and then flee across town and what have you and just pray there was no issue on the tube and all this sort of business. Arrive, I mean, I was sweating like something not right, because the weather has actually turned up in England finally. We've finally got into some sort of spring / early summer. So there was a real sense of, I'll be honest, relief in the first instance, particularly when I got into the Sheffield Tap. I got in at about 6:30-ish, and that was the first time I'd stopped for, like, you know, in the just everything was so hectic. I hadn't really had the opportunity to say, right, okay, here we are. This is the bit now. It was in that moment, sat in that pub, just waiting for you to turn up. I was there about 15 minutes before you. That's where it kind of started to sink in a bit. And all the adrenaline of the getting there really started to bubble up and what have you. And I was, blimey, I was like I must have looked to you like a child on Christmas morning.
You did. You had all your presents around and your feet. Actually, no, if you were a child on Christmas morning, I'd be ringing the social with your two pints in front of you. That's far too young to give a baby booze. You know, when we were walking down to the Lead Mill, when we first got in, because you always have that little doubt. It's like, I hope this ticket's okay. I know it is okay, but you know, you just have like that little moment doubt. And we got there a little bit later, didn't we, to miss the queue and to spend a little bit longer in the pub. So we essentially just, you know, walked in. There was no queue there at all. I think by the time we got there, which wasn't particularly late, I think it was about 8 o'clock or something like that, I can honestly say when we walked into the lead mill, I'm a man of a certain age and I've been to many, 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 many gigs. I've come to my peace with the sort of excitement of going to gigs was at its height for me, you know, probably like in the 90s when I was like a teenager and going to see bands for the first time where you would go and see anyone. When we were going into the lead mill, that's the most excited I've been going into any gig for decades, I would say.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like for me, that there was partly last year, I don't know if I've ever mentioned it on here, I went to see Maiden in Lisbon. And one of the main reasons why that one was so important to me was because they played in a really crumbly, beautiful old Olympic Stadium in Lisbon, which is just an aesthetically really special place to be. So I remember in the build-up to that feeling pretty giddy, but that was so much more about the setting than the band. As much as I absolutely adore Iron Maiden, that was so much to do with where I was. I traveled to a foreign country for it, which of course so many people had done, and I think it's just worth mentioning that. In and around the Lead Mill and Bramall Lane. That obviously we met a lot of people we know from overseas through the podcast and through various Facebook groups and what have you. Some people have put incredible amounts of time and money into being at these shows. So when I talk about my frantic sort of run across London and then, you know, a train to Sheffield and you drove across, you ended up taking, you didn't take the 62, did you? You did Wadhead Pass in the end, didn't you, to get from Liverpool over to Sheffield. I think
I don't know exactly what way I went. There was a crash or something and a sat nav just redirected me and I just followed it blindly. I ended up on the A6. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we, compared to what other people did, that is so unbelievably small fry. So I think it's really worth pointing that out, that some people just went to incredible lengths to make sure they were at these shows. But yes, excitement level. I mean, the thing that got me as well when we first walked into the venue was I've been to so, like you, Neil, I've been to so many of these smaller venues. Quite a lot of them are long and thin. So the stage is a thin end of a room and you actually end up being stood quite far back, as intimate a setting as it is. The Lead Mill was wide and fat, basically. Mm. So you, wherever you were stood, you couldn't be that far from the stage. There wasn't a distant position to be wherever you were in there. So the sight lines for the gig were absolutely fantastic. We ended up sort of stood in, we eventually made our way, we went to the bar at the back, didn't we? And then we made our way kind of, well, basically towards the middle-ish, I would have suggested is where we were, maybe about sort of 8 people back.
Yeah, absolutely. If anyone has seen the live stream of this, or they've seen the YouTube videos that have been ripped off and are on YouTube now, that main camera angle that you see where it's just like looking at the whole stage and you can see all 5 of them, that was essentially exactly our view. We were absolutely in the center. We were towards the back, but not quite at the back. And we were just dead center. There was a lot of people who were like a lot closer and everything. And we're going to get onto the band and the set list in a minute. Have you still got your can of Lead Mill Def Leppard, £7.50. I moaned at the barman, didn't I? Well, I definitely made some point of saying £7.50.
Yeah, I don't think you were the only one.
Because I started asking him how much a normal pint was to find out it was £6.50. So either way, fucking hell.
And given that's the case, what a dickhead I am for not having the can anymore, to answer the question. Have you got yours?
All the way. I mean, I think we got through 6 of them. So, well, we got through, what's that feel? I don't know. We got through £45 worth of, which sounds like pints and pints and pints, doesn't it? It was 6. We got through 6 cans and people were just tapping me on the shoulder going, do you want that? And I was like, no, because I can't be arsed carrying cans around with me, Paul. I'm not going to lie. So I just give them away to the sorts of people around me was asking. And then when it got outside, someone said like, there was only 500 of them or 200. I can't remember, but there was a limited number of them. And I'd like to say that at that point, I thought, oh no, what have I done? But I was still thinking I'd rather just not carry them around for a weekend and then just have them in my room. And then they'd end up, all it would be an empty beer can here in my Sparkle Lounge. Mrs. Def Leppard will just end up lashing it anyway. So it's either that or I put it in my cupboard. And then I've just got an empty beer can. So no, I haven't. But and obviously you haven't either.
No, I do regret it, but it was the practicality wasn't. I mean, I was just, so again to the point about the weather had warmed up a bit, but also it was a sweaty, grimy, proper club gig. I was in short and t-shirts. I didn't have a jacket, no other bag or anything like that. I didn't have anything to put it in. You know what I mean? It was absolutely you were in your jeans, weren't you? Were you not absolutely roasting in there?
No, I was all right. I wore my shorts on the Monday to Bramall Lane. But I'm a young man with a good metabolism and, you know, I don't sweat, you know, or anything. So, I was fine. But let's talk about that moment as you were sweating in your shorts and I was totally fine in my jeans. You know, just before they came on, I think I turned to you and said, this just doesn't feel real, like it's about to happen.
Yeah, the whole thing had an etherealness, if that's even a word, to it. Think, what is it about? You know, when bands appear on stage and you clap your eyes on them for the first time, and this is particularly prevalent when it is your first time seeing a band, there really is something truly magic about that moment, because previously these people have tended to be figures that you've seen on the television, or at most you've seen them on the television. And of course, when you're a really big fan of a band, to the point whereby, you know, like, you do know who all the individual members are, because frankly, there'll have been a lot of people inside Bramall Lane who don't know who all the individual members are, and they don't know about them to the degree that we do, and that's fine. You know, there's loads of bands that I'm probably like that for, well, I'm definitely like that for, so nothing wrong with it. But when actually, what, how many metres away from us? Less than 10 metres, I would say. I know we were a bit further to the back. Let's say 10 metres for the sake of argument. 10 metres away from you are these people who you have placed on a pedestal, for good or bad, you have placed on a pedestal your whole life. Barring going to a book signing, that's not the same either, because you're not actually seeing them do their day job. To see them do their day job up close like that, it doesn't feel real until the minute it happens, because it just feels a bit like, well, it can't possibly happen. I don't know that I've explained that very, very well, but yeah, to follow on from your point, I felt exactly the same way.
That bit where the lights go off, there really was a frisson of excitement in the air. I've been very mindful of coming in to record this and, like, you know, like, let's not over-egg things. Let's not just go ridiculously effusive and over the top, you know, unless it's deserved and anything. But I do think that atmosphere when they, you know, waiting for them to come on, and when they came on and when certain songs kicked in, which we'll get into in a minute, it was special, wasn't it? It was
electric. And what I'll definitely say, as opposed to any other gig I'd ever been to, it was the most special version of that. I've never known an anticipation and a crackle quite like that. And it stands to some reason. As I mentioned, a lot of people had travelled a long way. They'd spent a lot of money on it. We were an incredibly lucky group of people to be inside that room on that night. And that was massive in my mind. There'll be lots of people listening to this who are thinking, you know, God, I would have wished so badly to have been there. People who tried to get there and had all this frustration online. It really, really came home to me how unbelievably privileged I was to be inside that room on that Friday night.
And you said the word crackle there. And before we go into sort of the set list a little bit, just in terms of general impressions, one thing that definitely wasn't crackle and pull was the sound. I was blown away by how good the sound was. There wasn't even that, you know, where you just have to get it sorted and adjust things after the first song. It's like literally from the first second they came in, you could hear everything as clear as day. They sounded brilliant. There's just an absolute quality that pervaded the band, they're playing, the sound itself. And also listening to these bootleg versions that I've managed to get my hands on as well, which I think is essentially just the audio from the live stream, by the way. When you watch something, because you've got multiple sensors going, ear isn't as attuned to the sound. So things can sound better than they really are just because you're also looking at something. So I've made a point of just listening to it as opposed to watching it. And even just listening to it, where you've got a heightened sensitivity to all of the little flaws and all the little things going wrong. I've listened to just two songs in particular, which will probably indicate what a couple of my highlights were, which was Too Late for Love and Mirror Mirror. It just sounds incredible. And when we came out as well, and I think I was telling you on like Twitter, on Facebook, on Def Leppard's Discord, I managed to just quickly see all of the people who weren't there, who were watching it on the live stream, who were going, this is incredible. This is brilliant. This sounds so good. And that was really, really great to hear, because sometimes you're thinking, am I getting a slightly different biased opinion of it, or it's so loud you can't quite hear all your imperfections. But I think no matter how you experienced that Lead Mill gig, whether you were there or whether you, you know, made a big thing about it, watching it on the stream and like made an event of it yourself, which from what I can see, loads and loads of people did. This was perceived by everyone else as the absolute reality of what it was, which was a fucking awesome Def Leppard gig.
Yeah, I think it's one of those that would have raised an eyebrow among the kind of a certain fraternity who would have looked at it and gone, there's no way you can play live that well. There is no way you can sound that good and it be live. It was live. We will come to what not live sounds like, I guess, when we touch a little bit on the band who, for the sake of this conversation, supported Def Leppard at Bramall Lane. Every single thing was organic inside the Lead Mill on that night, from crowd reaction through to band behaviours through to their playing. And every single band member was kind of afforded a little spotlight across all both of the gigs. And that felt like a pleasure as well, like something I've often thought, and it really didn't happen at the Lead Mill in particular. There is an element of Vivian being, sidelined is the wrong word, but Phil is your main guitar player. Vivian, on a number of occasions at the Lead Mill, was literally given a spotlight and sort of stood off to one side. Well, not spotted just on his own, but, you know, he was lit up in particular. And he was given quite a bit of work and to do and room to play. And that was just great to see as well. It almost felt to me like I was seeing something ever so slightly different even before you get into the set in terms of the way they were performing. Again, maybe that was my imagination, but given you could see, you were close enough to see the fingers move and the sound was so good that you could hear the noise that was being made. And that might sound like a really stupid thing to say, but there are tons, the majority of gigs you go to, that will not be the live experience, to literally see the fingers move or the mouth move and hear the noise coming out. It was remarkably good.
It was. So let's go on to that set list. Let's just go through what they did. As I'm going through this, Paul, as well, let's you and I very smugly reference in our own minds back to episode 58 and our predictions. And let's very smugly talk about what we got right. We could just forget what we got wrong. Let's just talk about what we got right. So we start off with Action. You know, already, I feel the need to comment on everything as they come up, but I'm not. I'm just going to go for it. Right. They start off with Action. Second is Fire It Up. Then they go into Let It Go. Too Late for Love. Excitable. Mirror, Mirror. I'm laughing because it's amazing. Slang. Kick. Bringing on a Heartbreak. Switch 625. Hysteria. Sugar. And then they go off and they come back on for the encore and they play Wasted. Right, what did we get right in terms of our predictions?
I think I can only claim one, which was Action, because I suggested that they might play a UK hit that would count as a deep cut. So I think I got Action right. Somebody mentioned Wasted. That might have been in like the Facebook group. So sorry to whoever it was. It might even have been you, Neil. But Wasted had been predicted by some people. I can't remember if it was. It certainly wasn't me, I don't think. So the only one I can really say, Neil, to be honest, is Action. You've got a few.
Well, we're a team, so we're going to take collective responsibility and liability for being spot on. Yeah, so we got Action. I said as well that it'd be great if they could play stuff from Diamond Star Halos, and as a minimum, we knew that they played Fire It Up on a stadium tour in the States. So we knew that that was in the fingers and in the minds and in the muscle memory ready to play. And we got that second. Also said that the default position of Def Leppard when they do deep cuts is high and dry. And we said stuff that they don't normally play from the first side of High and Dry. And plus, maybe a Mirror, Mirror. Yes. So we got Let It Go. We got Mirror. We got Heartbreak, which you play anyway. We got Switch 625. I did say Wasted, by the way. That was me. I will take credit for that. Even though it makes me sound like a narcissist, that was another time that we were right. Okay. And Also, we did talk a little about maybe getting something from Pyromania, which we did, Too Late for Love. And I think the way that we sort of talked about it was the likelihood of the other things that we might get are the other types of things that they played at Vegas in 2019, which pretty much all of, if not, like, so for example, Excitable was played in Vegas. Slang was played in Vegas. So I think, I mean, it was great when we were playing it, when all of these songs were like coming out, and we're like, oh my God, it's Too Late for Love. Oh my God, it's like Mirror Mirror. Oh my God, it's Let It Go. But I was just doubling down on just the absolute smugness of us getting it right. I mean, I would say that was the best part of the weekend, was being right, which is terrible of me. Right. First thing I'm going to ask you about, do you know what we both got? We both got songs that we're not that keen on. So I want to know what you thought of the song that you weren't keen on. So you're not that keen on Excitable. We got Excitable. I'm not that keen on Slang. We got Slang. How did you find Excitable, Paul?
I had said, in my defense, when we were on the Hysteria Side 2 review, that Excitable is a different song live. And if I didn't say it, then trust me, I was thinking it. So that was quite funny, actually, when it came on, wasn't it? You actually sort of turned to me and gave me a little funny look or a little nudge or something like that. I went, hey, come on, your favourite song. Yeah. I thought it went down absolutely brilliantly. And it does sound better live. It's as simple as that. I don't really know what the mechanics behind that are, but it wasn't as if I was going to turn me back and go, right, this is absolutely ridiculous. They should be playing Fooling in this spot or whatever it was. You know, I wasn't going to hurl one of them £7.50 cans at the stage and hope to knock one of them out. So I thought it came across really well. And it was just the cheeky little look on your face when it came on made it. So what about you for Slang?
I thought it was great. And I just, yeah. I thought that show, like many live shows, but that one in particular, it's just a completely different dynamic. It's a different atmosphere. It's a different way to experience music. You're in a completely different headspace. And I'm not saying it doesn't matter what they play, but there is an element of, do you know what? We're here in the lead mill, are playing an hour. I don't care what they're playing. I'm just going to enjoy the shit out of this. So there is an element to that. And I absolutely love Slang. And I just love the fact that they were playing stuff that we don't normally get to see them play in the UK. I don't know the last time I saw them play Slang, but I doubt the year began with a 2. I might be wrong. It feels like it probably began with a 1 and a 9. But I could be entirely wrong on that because I haven't got a great memory for that sort of stuff. And if anything, I got my own. I was smugly looking at myself for Slang as well, going, ah, come on, Slang, yeah, you know, and all of the sort of bits that I don't particularly like. I was singing, you know, full blast and really, really enjoying it. So even the stuff that we're not entirely keen on just blew the doors off and was amazing at the Lead Mill, and genuinely, genuinely was. Have you got any particular highlights, any times during that gig where you were just like, oh, shit, the bed, this is amazing?
Yeah, I've had time to reflect on this, and I think my original thing that I said to you in the immediate aftermath, Mirror Mirror, was the one that really, really got me on the night. Bang in the middle of the set, sixth of 13 that we played. And I think one of the reasons why is because it invites a bit of crowd participation, because the crowd are supposed to sing the Take a Look Into My Eyes, and they did, which obviously they were going to do, but that all of a sudden, I think maybe I'm just looking through the set list now to see that I've got this right, and I think I have. I think in terms of that's the first in the set where the crowd were a truly fundamental part of the song performance. They've been a part of, like, obviously the whole event and the whole atmosphere and all this. But if you look at what was played ahead of it, there's nothing really in there that I can say is a big crowd participation moment. But because the crowd are so heavily involved in the chorus, that's what really stuck with me. What about you?
The only other bit, maybe, in terms of, I mean, there was crowd participation from second one in terms of just singing every word to every song. It was definitely there in that. It was there in the chorus to Too Late for Love, or that bit where it goes,
yes, of course.
And normally, when I've been at Def Leppard gigs, that doesn't normally get sung because there's not enough people there who know it. There's not enough people who know that. That's something that you can do in that part of the song. And even on live recordings, you can only often just hear it in the background. That's the best I've heard that bit sung by an audience. You know, like that Iron Maiden type of thing, you know, where people go, whoa, whoa, to a musical section as opposed to singing. I think we got that. Probably the best I've heard it. And actually not feeling like the knobhead who's the only person singing it on my own. And then, like, and no one else around you is. And, you know, they're all giving, like, weird side eyes. And then you sort of get a little bit self-conscious. And then you just start singing it slightly quieter. And then you just sort of stop. That's what was brilliant about this gig. There was no self-consciousness of being the only person who reacts to certain songs or certain parts of songs in a certain way. It's like everyone was like just like sort of going mad and like really maybe not going mad in terms of throwing the bodies around, but just in terms of like belting out the songs, I would say.
I was going to sort of dive into the other song that I thought went down really well in there was Kick. I thought that, and it was repeated on the Monday as well, where it worked brilliantly. And I'd caught some snippets from the previous World Tour, Stadium Tour, American leg of this, where I thought Kick had sounded ever so slightly, slightly sluggish, maybe. But in this atmosphere, it was given every ounce of energy that it could possibly have been given. And it came across absolutely brilliantly in there, I thought.
What I loved in particular was those first six songs. And I'll tell you why I love those first six songs so much. They had no clue what was coming next. And I know we don't want to get into this Def Leppard setlist thing. We've talked about it a million times. We all know why they have to play certain songs. We appreciate it. We get it. It's all great. I'm totally fine with it. I understand with it because we're going to get onto Bramall Lane later. And I'm telling you now, I think the Bramall Lane set list was absolutely perfect for that crowd. There's not one thing I would move in or out of it for what that crowd was. So I am not having a dig. I'm not having the dig at Def Leppard's set list. We know the score, right? But to be in that position at a Def Leppard show, I like literally... Action set the precedent. It's like, oh my God, they'll play an Action. Like Action, like that. It's just a funny song as well, I think. It just makes me laugh. It's just a humorous song. So straight away, they play that. Then they play Fired It Up, which they've never played in Britain before. And then those two songs straight away tells you you're in a very, very different place to where you normally are in a Def Leppard gig. And it doesn't matter that they've in the whole week beforehand, they've been telling you that, you know, we're going to play a different set list. We're going to play some stuff we haven't played before, right? Until you're there and then they're actually doing it. You don't really believe it. And what was fantastic is even though we had our predictions and even though we were so right on so many levels, as each song was coming to an end, there was an absolute visceral anticipation of, oh my God, what are they going to play next? And then the next four in particular for me, it was like each one got better. Well, to an extent, so they do Let It Go. You're like, oh my God, Let It Go. Amazing. Then he did Too Late for Love, which I'd just been listening to the Drastic Symphonies version in the car on the way up. And I'd only listened to it once. And I'm like, oh, this is really cool. I love Joe's new vocal on it. And then he said that they were going to do it in the way they did it, the new way. I'll be honest with you. At the time, being there, being a little bit excited, I couldn't massively hear the difference to the way they normally play it. But now I've listened back to it, I can hear it. It is quite subtle. It's just a nuance in terms of Joe singing a little bit lower, and it's just a slightly different intonation in the Too Late for Love bit. And stuff like that. So then he played Excitable, which was just funny because I know you don't like it. So it was just good seeing you like it. Okay. And then he played Mirror Mirror, which was the peak for me. That is just, I think for doing the podcast over the last few years as well, it feels particularly this year, lots of people, I've had lots of conversations with Mirror Mirror about with people and finding out that it's lots of people's favorite song of High and Dry. And it's, and, you know that about Coming Under Fire. You know that about You Got Me Running. But since I've really discovered how much people love Mirror Mirror, myself, over the last sort of year or so. And that's contagious because it makes you then go back and listen to it and rediscover it and everything. So, and we knew a lot of people in that crowd. And I knew there were certain people in there who was like, you could just figure, right, I know at least sort of 6, 7, 8 people in and out who are buzzing that they're sort of playing this. And we might not be standing by them, but it doesn't matter. And there was a real excitement in the crowd. So does that run up of that first 6 songs in particular was just, what was that like? A 20-minute, half-an-hour period, something like that. That half an hour is one of the best half an hours of Def Leppard I've ever seen and enjoyed.
Yeah, I mean, how on earth could I add to that? Except to say that had they played You Got Me Running instead of Mirror Mirror, maybe that would have been even more exciting because they probably, I mean, so I'm sure at some point on the High and Dry podcast, it was discussed as to what was played live off that album on that tour. The thing with Mirror Mirror is, of course, the second side, apart from, the second side of High and Dry, when they've gone back to High and Dry, we always think of it as side A, basically. It's side A that they mine more than anything else. So to get anything off side B was an unbelievable treat. And like I said, that's why I talked about the crowd thing, doing the sort of gang vocal thing. But it's like I said, that was my highlight of the whole thing. I will say, I don't at any point, bear in mind, so they'd started with Action, and that gave me actually, same as you were saying, a bit of confidence. And I did think for a minute, if we're ever going to see Make Love Like a Man, then it will be tonight as a result of them throwing Action in, because, of course, it was a bit of a hit in the UK. It was pretty clear that they were never... So Joe had said at the book launch on the Tuesday in London, and I don't want to misquote him, but it was the word he used was, I think he said something like, we're going to play some crazy stuff. He might have used the word crazy. Can you remember what word it was he used?
Change.
Strange. Okay, so we use the word strange. Whether it ever became fully strange or not, I think might be slightly up for debate. I think if they popped a Deliver Me or a Work It Out into there, then maybe it would have qualified as strange. Rare, perhaps. I mean, Wasted. I've got Setlist FM here, according to Wasted, first live performance, according to Setlist FM, Wasted, first live performance since 2018. And actually, as they were coming out for the encore, funny enough, that was the next time in that run where you wondered, what is this going to be? Because you figured, I can't remember if I turned around and said it to you, but I thought there is a real chance that Wasted is going to be the one they'll play here. And so first time in 5 years, absolutely delighted that they did. I mean, would you classify it as strange?
You know, what's that saying about the sum of the parts being more than the whole, or is it the whole being more than the sum of the parts? I would say those 6 songs together, if you would apply the whole being more than the sum of the parts in a strange context, I think those 6 songs together are pretty strange. Action, Fire It Up, Let It Go, Too Late for Love, Excitable, and Mirror Mirror. I think that's, you know what, and then throw Slang on the end of it and then Even Kick. Maybe those first 8 songs together, that's quite a strange set list, but an amazing sort of set list. And then obviously they go into Heartbreak, they go into Switch 625, Hysteria, Sugar, and Wasted's not a massive surprise. And I think everyone wanted it and everyone got it. What did you think of the new, I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast before, or our American friends and Canadian friends on the podcast from last year spoke about when they went to the stadium and tour. But it was our first experience of that new ending on Hysteria, and the way, not only that new ending on Hysteria, but I would also say the way it then transitions into Sugar, because it very much, there's nothing between it. They very much go from one to the other. What did you think of that whole part?
Loved it. There's a, if anyone watches the Justin Hawkins Rides Again videos on YouTube, he's done a whole video on the importance of the whoa that you referenced a little earlier in relation to Maiden fans do it over that. Maiden fans do it where they do a new melody over musical parts. That's a really common feature of live Maiden shows. Here it was done as call and response with Joe doing the whoa, whoa, whoas. The value of a whoa, 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 whoa is not to be underestimated. And you don't need to hear me say that. You can go and watch Justin Hawkins talk about it on his YouTube video. So I thought it was tremendous fun because it's a manufactured crowd participation bit to make sure you're being given something to do. It was, I thought it was great. What did you think?
I've been looking forward to that since last summer. You know, in the last episode, I was talking about how I just watched too much and I knew everything that was going to happen. But we'll talk about that in Bramall Lane because that didn't actually turn out quite how I thought it was. So I think I was doing all of the whoa-whoa stuff and loads of people in there were doing the whoa-whoa stuff before we were supposed to be doing the whoa-whoa stuff because there was obviously 800-odd other people in there who were like us where, yeah, we haven't seen this yet, but we have so seen it on YouTube and all of that. And we knew it was coming and we were looking forward to just going, whoa, for like best part of a year. So it's quite funny. It's like everyone's doing it well before Joe starts, you know, putting the mic out there, and that didn't happen at Bramall Lane, because obviously it's a different crowd. So that was cool, but I thought it's cool the way it just transitions into it, just comes down and then straight away into Sugar. I think like absolute brilliant showmanship and craft and structure and knowing, you know, how to bring a crowd up and down and everything. And obviously they did that at Bramall Lane, which we'll come to in a second. Now, I thought all that was cool. Right, I've got some listeners' highlights. What I've done, rather than name check everyone, I've actually sat down with, so I figured it on Twitter, I did it on Facebook, I did it on a few other things. I sat down with a pen and paper, Paul. This is the effort I go into. And I've identified trends, okay? So anything I tell you now is where multiple people have said it, okay? And there might be the odd one where it's not. But, right, mirror, mirror, shed loads said that was the highlight. So I asked people what their highlights was. Mirror, mirror, shed loads said that. Wasted, loads said that. A lot of people mentioned the little story, the preamble that Joe gave about when Steve, you know, back in the day came in and played this song, and he, you know, he says, cop this. And then again, you know, I mean, the stagecraft of it all and the showmanship, where then Phil then starts playing that riff. So that was cool. Too Late for Love, loads of people said that. Let It Go, loads of people said that. Slang, loads of people said that. Also, outside of actual songs, loads of people just said it's just the sound was amazing. So exactly what we just said. And one thing I noticed as well, and you always like to see this, is you could see that they were enjoying it too. I think particularly Sav. Sav looked really happy. like, you know, he looked like, oh, you know what? I could do a bit more of this. This is cool playing these songs in this environment. And, you know, it's good to see, you know, it's good to see. You go to see your band. You want your band to be having a good time and everyone to sort of be engaged in that sort of communal experience, you know, rather than it being an us and them, and it felt very much like an us and an us as such. So they were the highlights. One thing before we go on to Bramall Lane, what I will say about getting and the people who listen to this or and what they thought, going back to the idea about the event, I asked people, what were your highlights of the Leadmill show and what were your highlights of the Bramall Lane show, right? Loads of people went off track, which is cool, right? And started talking about all the things that weren't to do with the shows, which I think feel, you know, whether it be going on like going to see, loads of people went and did like, you know, tours of Sheffield to see Def Leppard sites. Lots of people in different groups, you know, went and did different things, met people that they hadn't met before or they only knew online, met people for the first time, you know, went on like signing things, did all sorts of like sort of stuff. You know, went to pubs, had breakfast together. Oh, I got my breakfast for free, by the way, on Tuesday morning in the Premier Inn, because when I went in, the computer broke and then they tried to fix it for 5 minutes. And then I just think that I couldn't be arsed. They went, I'll just go in, mate. So that was a highlight for me. But I think that all adds to the idea about this being an event as well, just to sort of go back to what we said earlier. We'll be right back.
Let's do this again one day. Thank you. Big up. Take care. See you soon. Maybe.
Shall we go to Bramall Lane, Paul?
Let's go.
Right. Two ways we could do this. I could go through the set list. Right, I'm going to give you a choice. I can read you a review. I can read you most of a review. We can do the set list, or we can get Motley Crue out of the way now.
Can we quickly get Motley Crue out of the way, but do it by referring to a particular passage in that Guardian review? So I am very quickly going to find this passage, which I've got saved somewhere. So just bear with me a second. Everyone talk amongst themselves for a minute whilst I do this, because there's one particular bit that I really want to draw people's attention to. Here we go. The Guardian Review. The Guardian, for anyone who doesn't know, is a British newspaper. It's what we traditionally was termed a broadsheet newspaper. So it's a clever person's newspaper. And it gave the whole gig 3 stars. Now, for those of us who were about to talk about the Def Leppard part of this, 3 stars sounds absolutely ridiculous. And the reason it gets 3 stars is probably explained in this passage that I'm going to read from the review. So if you don't mind, Neil, can I just go in and just give this little passage? On this showing, it's a calamity that said cessation contract wasn't irrevocable. That's referring to the contract that Motley Crue signed in 2015 saying they'd never play again. In 2023, Motley Crue's live fare is a relic in real time. There's no denying Dr. Feelgood's propulsive stomp or Kickstart My Heart's high-octane riffage, but both Vince Neil's range and ability to project his voice have all but abandoned him, and the singer struggles to keep up from the get-go. But it's drummer Tommy Lee, a married 60-year-old father of two, who best encapsulates the vibe. "Where are the titties? I don't see one pair of titties," Lee laments, lingering at the front of the stage. "Shall we pull our dicks out?" Mercifully, he marches back to his kit. I thought Motley Crue exceeded my expectations. But the idea that they are a relic is, I think, on that evidence, an entirely fair one. I think the Dancing Girls thing is absolutely ridiculous. I think we have to touch on, given we've talked about how good the sound was at the Leadmill, and we're going to come to talk about Def Leppard's sound, I think we have to talk about the obnoxiousness of Motley Crue's sound. I don't know, Neil, if you know, does the rest of that review, does it pick up on that, the bass, and in particular, the Tommy Lee's kick drum?
This is what I found astonishing about this review, that it doesn't mention the sound, which says to me that there must be a bit of a discrepancy on how bad that sound was compared to where you were. So I was in the Golden Circle bit, right? And I was quite near the front. However, can I just say, I've seen miles heavier bands than Motley Crue, who seem to think they are like a hard band, which, you know what, as men, they might be. I'm sure they could all batter us, right? But in terms of thinking that this is like really tough music, you're having a laugh. It absolutely isn't, okay? It's 80s glam LA shit, right? What I would say is, and I am always, I try to be as level-handed, you know, as I can, you know, like not just like sort of throw shit on anything, but I would say, fuck Motley Crue, honest to fucking God. It was absolutely ridiculous how loud it was, and all you could hear for the first half an hour was the bass and the drums. And there was people around me who were massive Motley Crue fans, and people around me who had come from overseas and come a long way and paid a lot of money to see them. I saw fellas with Motley Crue t-shirts on who were like just like trying to get into it the first few songs, shaking their head, turning around and leaving it. There's people that we were with as well who absolutely gutted how shit it sounded. If you didn't know the songs where we were, right? Okay, if you didn't know the songs, you wouldn't know what they were singing. That's how unbelievably loud the bass, drum was and the bass, and you couldn't hear anything else. No wonder Mick Mars wanted to leave that band, because being a guitarist in that band is fucking pointless. It's absolutely pointless. And he was good. That John Five fella, I was watching him. He's clearly excellent. He was one of the most watchable things. He's dead good. He's quite likable as well. And he was good. And later on, when they sorted the sound out a little bit, okay, and you could hear it a little bit more, he's good. And that's my thing with Motley Crue. I figured these could be good. Because I was saying I wasn't that bothered. I stood through the 90 minutes because I didn't want to leave. I had a really good space and I didn't want to leave it. But you had Motley Crue fans leaving. You had literally people with their fingers in their ears, Paul, right? Because that's the only way. Because I'm not being funny. It blew my fucking ears out. And I swear it affected my experience of Def Leppard, because it was like my head was underwater. And I honestly think it's like libelously loud. And what I did is I messaged a few people while I was there who I knew were in different parts of the crowd, and to find out whether the sound was as bad for them. So someone that we know was over in one stand, and he just said, it's a mess. All I can hear is like the bass. So he was like well further back. And then on the other stand opposite, someone else said exactly the same. It was all of the bass. But I've watched YouTube videos back, and you definitely don't seem to have had that horrific experience that I had. So I think maybe if you were central and you were further back, it was just, that's a bit of a crap sound, as opposed to I want my money back sound. It's like, yeah, this is a joke. So my question to you is, you obviously never had that experience. You know, it must have sounded better based on what you're saying. So where were you exactly? Because we've not even spoke about this. Where were you in Bramall Lane?
So I was probably about on the halfway line, which might make it sound like I was a long way back from the stage. But because of the way it was staged, the stage was positioned about, you would say, if you can picture a soccer pitch, it was positioned about a quarter of the way along the pitch. So I'm on the halfway line, so another quarter back, if you like. And the reason I can say this is because I took a picture of the Tony Curry stand. The Tony Curry stand was off to my left, so the stage was off to my left as well. And we were kind of so we were quite well positioned to probably not it maybe necessarily the best view, but certainly the thing with the sound was from where we were, John Five's guitar cut through, I would say, throughout. And the thing about the bass, the kick drum was obnoxious. It was obnoxious all the way through. You could feel the floor literally vibrate every single time. But I don't think from where we were stood, we quite got the full force of what you got and what a lot of other people experienced, which isn't to say that the sound was good. It wasn't. The kick drum was ridiculous. I've made a decision around Wembley. I'm not going to go in and see them at Wembley. I'm going to stay in the pub and I'm going to have a few more drinks because we met again, didn't we? We actually met on the train, as anyone who listened to the review show or anyone who's seen my Twitter will see that I did present Neil with a picnic. Yeah. And it was a decent little spread, wasn't it, for an hour's train journey?
It was.
So
it was lovely.
We did that. We made our way into the pub and we ended up in a cracking boozer. Oh, can you remember what it was called?
Arundel Arms, it was called. The second pub that we went into, yeah.
Yeah, the one after. So we went in the Sheffield Tap first because the Sheffield Tap is a cracking pub. The one we went in, we tried to get in the beer garden at first, and then we were with Greg and Raymond, that one.
It was called the Arundel or the Arundel or something. Like, it was called the Arundel something. It was cool. It was brilliant in there. I could have sat in there all night, I'll be honest with you. I was just getting into my flow.
And I was in exactly the same mood. And I think if I had my time again, knowing what I know, I would not have seen Motley Crue. I would have spent that time in that company because we were having such a good time in that pub. So at Wembley, I'm not going to make the same mistake. At Wembley, I am going to skip Crue and I'm going to have a few beers, a few extra beers. One thing in fairness that I absolutely, like I said, they exceeded my expectation. And I actually had a good time because the sound wasn't as offensive as has been described elsewhere. The crowd, there was a lot more Motley shirts than I expected. Crue, there were plenty of people there who were there to see and enjoy Motley Crue. And as such, the crowd around me actually was pretty good for them, but by the time we got into it, and I'm going to call back to something you said about the sing-along thing inside the Leadmill. another thing my position inside that stadium on the Monday gave me was I was able to hear the crowd better than you were, because we've discussed this kind of ahead of recording. And the crowd were phenomenal for the Def Leppard show. You could hear every single word being sung across the stadium, because where I was, you could hear it coming down from the terrace off on my right-hand side, just like at a football match. That was the impression that you got from it. And that was really, really clear throughout the Def Leppard set. So it was like there was way more than just your casual fan in there. Everyone knew every word, so a hell of a lot of it.
Right, I want to touch that. I want to leave Motley Crue behind now, because that's 90 minutes of my life I'm never going to get back, and possibly my hearing. I'm going to go through the set list first, and this is why I was really keen on talking to you. I had a brilliant experience at Bramall Lane because of where it was, but it was a very different experience to what you had, because what you were. And this is what's cool about it. When you're at a venue that big, you can have different experiences, and it can be all equally good in different ways. So because I was so close to the front, the one thing that you don't get is you don't quite get the full perspective of the size of it, of the grandeur of it, and audibly as well, in terms of I could hear it on Pour Some Sugar On Me, but there wasn't loads of times when I could totally hear the crowd, because obviously he's so close to the front. So we're going to kill two birds with one stone. I'm going to go through the set list that he played. Tell me which ones were particularly good for the old crowd sing-alongs that I might not have been aware of just because I was so close to the front. So they start with Take What You Want. Then he played Let's Get Rocked. Then he played Animal. Then he played Foolin'. Then he played Armageddon. Then he played Kick. Then he played Love Bites, Promises. Then he did a little acoustic interlude, this guitar. And then When Love and Hate Collide, which started off acoustically and then went to the full electric version. Then we went to Rocket, Bringing On a Heartbreak, Switch 625, Hysteria, Pour Some Sugar On Me, Rock of Ages, and Photograph. So you could say, you said you could hear on many occasions, you know, the words being sung out around the stadium. And I think it was on Pour Some Sugar On Me that Joe said something about how good the crowd sounded. So other than Pour Some Sugar On Me, which is the obvious one, what else went down really well from the crowd in terms of sing-along from where you were?
Yeah, Let's Get Rocked was the first moment where it was really, really clear. Probably worth remembering that Let's Get Rocked was a big hit in the UK a long time ago, though, which actually just do want to touch on. I don't know what it was like where you were in the Golden Circle. The crowd age was significantly younger than you've any right to expect at a Def Leppard gig. I am 42 years old, and I would suggest that I was not at the older range of what was in there. We were surrounded by people who were clearly younger than us and were having an absolute whale of a time. So I think that's just worth getting out there, that they really did. They're attracting somehow, some way, a younger audience. It's brilliant. So Let's Get Rocked was absolutely great. When Love and Hate Collide, another one, again, was a big UK hit. So therefore, you'd expect it. And I'm sure we'll talk about the version they did on that. Rocket, again, because it's huge crowd participation, chorus. Sugar, we have to touch on it because it went absolutely fucking ballistic where I was, Neil.
I would say that's the best experience I've had of Pour Some Sugar At Me at any Def Leppard gig. I'm not saying that it was the best Def Leppard gig I've been to, but that was the best Pour Some Sugar On Me I think I've experienced at any Def Leppard concert. And I think pretty much from When Love and Hate Collide, and I think from When Love and Hate Collide, just to remind people, When Love and Hate Collide, Rocket, Bring It On a Heartbreak, Switch 625, Hysteria, Pour Some Sugar On Me, Rock of Ages, Photograph. So this is the sort of the back end. There's no denying as well that things get a bit more special as it gets a bit darker. And the lights and all of that start to have more impact. And for me, the whole thing was great. And a lot of my highlights are actually earlier on. But from When Love and Hate Collide, that for me was when I was like, oh yeah. Well, you can never change your heart. You will never change your mind. Did the slam down the phone, girl, for the 100th time? Got your number on my wall. I ain't gonna make that call. When divided we stand, baby.
matter at all. Got the time, got a chance, gonna make it. Got my hands on your heart, gonna take it. All I know, I can fight this way. You could have a change of heart. You would only change your mind. Cause I'm crazy about you, baby. The time after time, without you, I'm not alone. Just like a year without you, baby. Do you have a heart of stone? Without you, can't stop the hurt inside.
Yeah, this is a really good one. You know, you can sort of go through Def Leppard concerts that you've been to, or all concerts, it doesn't matter. And you can go, oh, this is a keeper. This is a keeper, isn't it?
Yeah, the way they did it, and I hope my memory will hold up here, that they did the acoustic... How long did they do the acoustic for? Was it like one verse, one chorus? Can you remember how... Or was it just like one quick verse? How did it go? Can you remember?
It was up to the first chorus, I think, and then on When Love and Hate Collide, so this guitar is all acoustic, except for the guitar solo, and then When Love and Hate Collide, I think they do one verse, they do one chorus, and then I think it was when they went into the second verse that it went electric.
Right, and what it really did for me, that arrangement of it, and coming out of this guitar, it worked so, so well. What it did for me, I've said before, so When Love and Hate Collide is my favourite song of all time. Anyone wants to hear more about that? Episode 9 of Def Leppard Pod, everyone. It's my favourite song of all time. Live, I've always thought it misses Michael Kamen's strings. And because Def Leppard don't use tapes, you don't get any backing, but any string backing. But by they removed the need for that. Because of you don't need that when it's completely stripped down into the acoustic. So all of a sudden that was gone. And I thought it worked brilliantly, as opposed to when they've done it, when I've heard them do it previously and it's just done electric all the way through. I thought that segue worked absolutely fantastically. I should say as well, because what they did was, I mean, it's arguable in this patch, and this patch will change as they go through, certainly when they go back to the US. I think this will change, because when Love and Hate Collide wasn't a hit in the US, it was a hit in Canada, but it wasn't a hit in the US. So I suspect that might get dropped out for something else. You went this guitar when Love and Hate Collide, then you had Rocket, then you had Bringing On the Heartbreak. Now, in theory, that's four ballads in three. But the way Bringing On the Heartbreak took off, and this was one of them, honest to God, the way that the sound careened down from the stand off to my right, I feel bad for not knowing what the name of that stand at Bramall Lane is, the one opposite the Tony Curry stand. The way the sound rolled across there was really prevalent on Bringing On the Heartbreak. And Neil, you just touched on the way that as it got darker, kind of the lights start to have more impact. We should also know how incredible the stage production was. It was an absolutely phenomenal video display that they had. Because, and you have to have these big displays at stadium shows, because frankly, from where I was stood, quite often difficult to pick out band members. I mean, I'm quite a short guy as well. I'm only 5'8". So I spent a lot of my time looking at the screens to get a good up close look. And I thought the production around all of that was absolutely epic. I wonder where you were. You probably maybe didn't get as much of that. Would that be a fair guess?
That's exactly it. I mean, obviously I could see what was on the screens, but you spend less time looking at stuff on the screens because you're like, I was arguably closer, Paul, than we were at the Leadmill to the band. That's how close I was, because it was proper standing, you know, on the pitch where, you know, as opposed to there was seats there. I was probably like about four deep back, which isn't much. And then you got the cool, yeah, that thrust bit that comes out. So that was interesting as well, because you're looking forward watching the band. But then when like Joe or Sav, primarily it seems to be, or Viv as well, and Phil to a lesser extent, I think, come on that thrust, they then come past you with the side and then they're behind you. And then you turn around and watching them sort of from behind and the side as well. So because it's the opposite essentially of what you said, because the band was so visible and the band were visible in front of you and at the side of you as well, and you could see them so well. And it's that whole sort of like stagecraft and dynamic about the way they use the thrust and when they come out and like, you know, they stand together and they play Switch 65 or, you know, when he did This Guitar and When Love and Hate Collide. There's loads of band to look at. There's loads and loads of things going on with the band. So that's why I'm really, and I was aware of it at the time and I was like, this is cool. The other thing I'm thinking in the back of my head is I can't wait to go and see this two more times from two different positions and see the same show, essentially, I would imagine, but get a completely different experience of it. So yeah, I suppose the one bit of production value that I really got that was particularly cool is, you know, when he played Love Bites, you know, they had those lights that come out like that spread out and they catch the smoke and it's all like hazy. So it's like, I don't know how to describe it, but those big like arc of light that come out, I was like right under that. So that was like going over my head and it was like being in a spaceship or something. That was like really, really like cool. That was amazing.
Those the two really, I'd love to know if anyone else noticed this. I'm sure people did. So again, people listening so during Photograph, which was the last song of, it was the last song of the set. Yeah, because we didn't get an encore. And we didn't get an encore because obviously this is a co-headlining thing. So maybe we can touch on that a little bit more, but it does mean bringing crew up again. But it was a little disappointing, you know, if you're looking for little quibbles, that we didn't get the chance to shout more, come on you come and what have you. But during Photograph, they were putting on the video screen, like almost like Polaroid snaps of fans that they'd taken earlier in the day. So there were shots of fans at the barrier being put up on the big screen. So fans would have had the opportunity to see their own photograph appear during the song Photograph, which was great. And during Switch, they flashed up incredibly quickly. It was like subliminal, a shot of Steve Clark, just a photograph of him. It was like a headshot of Steve Clark that disappeared from view almost as soon as it had appeared. But it was, so like I said, it was almost a subliminal thing to make sure that everybody got Steve in their heads for that particular performance. Just two lovely production touches.
See, I never noticed that because there was so much going on because it was an assault on the senses. And that's what a stadium show should be. There should be lots of things going on and lots of things to look at. Can I just make one comment on the set list, the run of the set list, and then we'll talk a little bit about highlights. Is when this tour was on in the States last year, there was lots of talk about the acoustic bit being a lull. And when people mentioned that, I could understand how that might be the case. I would say, and you just touched on it then in terms of like the number of ballads, my experience was it didn't feel like that whatsoever. And that's not me being like, you know, Def Leppard super fan with a podcast and being a knobhead. I just would be genuine feelings on it. Is that because it went, take what you want, let's get rocked. Animal might be mid-paced, but it's like quite like an intense song. Then it went Fooling, which other than the bit at the start is, you know, like a faster upbeat song. And by the way, Fooling was amazing. For all my talk in the past about Fooling could be one that you could drop, I absolutely enjoyed the shit out of Fooling. I think at that point, when if you took those first four songs, if you were to end it then, Fooling would have been my favourite song and the one I enjoyed the most. Then you did Armageddon, then you did Kick. That felt like bang, bang. That just felt like banger after banger to me. That was like hit after hit after hit after upbeat song. Then you've got Love Bites. So then you get your first ballad. But you know what? It's Love Bites and it's amazing, right? And then you went into Promises. And I forgot that it was likely they were going to play Promises. And I don't know about you, but round by me, Promises went down an absolute storm.
Make some noise, please, Mr. Phil Collins! I'm gonna save you. Stop crying.
everyone was singing it word for word. And I was like, again, I talked about the best time I've seen Sugar. I've seen Promises be played a few times. That's by far the best I've heard them play it. And that is by far the best crowd reaction. And that's by far the most I've enjoyed it. Was Promises like that round by you as well, or a bit different?
100%. I was. You've basically taken the words completely out of my mouth. That's exactly what I was going to say. I spent the day. It was such a special day in so many ways. So I spent that Monday in the company of the love of my life, and Kat was there as well, Neil. So she is not a big Def Leppard fan. She was there, you know, for me, and also, you know, she's interested in Motley Crue. I swear to God, during Promises, I absolutely saw her sort of swaying along to it, because Promises is it's very kind of animal-ish. It's classic pop rock. Promises, isn't it? And it's one you can absolutely swing along to, and it's just, it went down an absolute storm. And just seeing it, she sort of stood just in front of me and to my right, and just thinking, oh, she's having a fucking good time here. And that was great.
Right, and so as we said, we get to Promises, and this is sort of my point. Now at song number 9, you finally get your first real mellow bit. Like I said, you've had Take What You Want, Let's Get Rocked, Animal Fooling, Armageddon, Kick. Little bit of a break, if you want to call it that, with Love Bites, but it's still a very full sounding song. You get Promises, and then it's only then that you get This Guitar, and then you get When Love and Hate Collide. And that, to me, did not feel remotely like a lull. That felt like a really good thing to do in that show at that time, to break it up a little bit. And I love This Guitar. I think it's a really, really good song. It went down reasonably well from the people around me. I'd be lying if everyone was singing their heart out. They weren't. Okay, but, you know, it went down well, and there was none of this leaving to go to the bar thing that we've talked about in the past. And that went down, like, really, really well. The band clearly loved that song and liked playing it as well. And then you get When Love and Hate Collide. And then, again, When Love and Hate Collide, yeah, it's a ballad, but it was a big sing-along. And what happened around us, Paul, was amazing. It was good. It was really, really good. I can't remember who started it, but it ended up with about 10 of us, all with our arms around each other in a circle, you know, like all facing each other, not even like watching a band, singing along to When Love and Hate Collide, certainly for the start of it, and up until a bit where it went electric. And it was just ace. It was just a really, really, like, sort of good experience. And you know the way I'm a sociopath, and I've got a heart of stone, and people had said to me before, like, oh, I cry at this song, and I cry at this song. I had actually felt a little bit like, sort of, I might cry, you're an animal, for some reason. I don't know why. It just came on me. Maybe I'm an emotional wreck at the moment with things going on. I'm susceptible to this stuff. I don't know. But when this sort of, like, this ring of people with their arms around each other really organically formed, and we were all just singing When Love and Hate collided, everything, I did start crying, because I was like, oh, fucking hell, this is nice. I know I had English teachers at school who said never use the word nice, okay, but fuck them. It was nice. It was just really, really, like, just, I'm very, very cynical. You know, you watch all of these like, sort of, your program is about, you know, I just want to make connections with people and all of this sort of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, go fuck yourselves. I don't really believe it. Right. Okay. There was a connection there. It was good. And the good news is I don't think anyone saw me either. So I could still be my alpha male, toxic masculinity knobhead that I am. I think one friend that we know, Big Collector, did see it. And it was sort of a little bit like the way that I was smug at you when you were quite, like, an excitable. He was quite smug at the fact that I was crying. My only thing is now, and actually it's just come to mind, we should mention this, is I hope that hasn't been captured on film. Because I'll sue them. I'm not having me crying on a DVD. That's just, you know, I know I'm creative and sensitive, but I don't want the world to see it, Paul. So that was really cool. I have just mentioned the fact that it was getting filmed. To what degree, so Joe mentioned it, to what degree do you think that was being filmed? Film for what?
Yeah, Okay, so let's just cut straight to the chase. Do we think it's being filmed for like a live concert DVD or something like that? Because obviously they'll be using tons of footage for the behind the scenes videos and stuff like this. They'll be using it as B-roll, I think, is to use the industry term. Same question around the lead mill, because let's face it, both of those could stomach a release of some sort, couldn't they? You know, I think both of them would, especially at this point, because as we mentioned, they're so current, which seems such a bizarre thing to say, but at the moment it's true. So I don't know. Could I see that being reproduced as a live performance DVD? Yeah, absolutely. I suspect that the primary reason for filming it is to get B-roll.
Yeah. The only other thing that it could be is we were speaking to a couple of people who went in the pub and queued up at the lead mill. And a few people said to us that they were interviewed or talked to or filmed by some people from Netflix, so which would indicate that there's a documentary being made. And when I was at the HMV signing, before Def Leppard came out, there was a full-on camera crew with clearly a director who was very animated, talking to other people, showing them what shots he wanted and things like this. So it wasn't, it was way more than, you know, the vlog stuff that you see, that Ryan Sebastian, I think he films all of that. You know, I think it's a bit of a one-man show, and what an excellent one-man show that is, by the way. The stuff that he's done over the years is just fantastic in terms of, like, just keeping the band, you know, in mind and sort of, you know, contactable and accessible. So, but there was other people filming for something that seemed more directorial. So, and I know that they had been filming a documentary up until 2018. Now I'm wondering if they're going to take that, and now they're doing this. And it would seem to me like a documentary's got to have a narrative arc. And it would seem to me that a good culmination and a final part of a Def Leppard documentary would be the gloriously successful homecoming gig. And maybe that footage forms the end of it. I don't know. Maybe the sort of figure, well, let's see how Wembley goes. And maybe Wembley becomes the culmination of it. I don't know. So it'll be interesting to see whether it is this B-roll stuff, whether it is a full concert release, or whether it is part of some sort of Netflix documentary or something like that that appears to be going on in the background. We'll find out. Okay. So, Paul, get When Love and Hate Collide. The band stop because they see me crying. They think, let Neil just get himself together again, okay? And then they go into Rocket. Right. I said it to the people around me at the time. I'll say it again now. They played 17 songs. I could listen to Rocket 17 times, Paul.
I'm just quickly flicking it. What is the single biggest crowd? When I talk about crowd participation, I am specifically referring to bits that the crowd are very much expected to do. So not just singing along with the words, which is actually what happened with Pour Some Sugar on Me, for example, but actually they are openly expected to be a part of the spectacle. And the chorus in Rocket is just that writ large, isn't it? Is it their best live song overall, Rocket?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, you can, there's loads and loads of song support in the conversation. Clearly there is. But no, I mean, I've done a whole podcast about the Rocket episode, and you're just not beating Rocket live. As I said before, it was the ultimate studio song that's become the ultimate live song. And whether it be, you know, the verse, or whether it just be that simple shouting out two syllables, Rocket, you know, or actually three syllables in it, Rocket, yeah. Whether it just be that bit, there's just something primal and visceral about that, where no one in the world, like, you know, people we know who don't like Def Leppard, the heathens that they are, you put them in the crowd, there's no way on earth they're not loving every single second of that. No, it is. It's the best Def Leppard live song. Fact.
Yeah, primal is a really, really good word. There's nothing wrong. Just briefly on your thing about, you know, you got very emotional during When Love and Hate Collide. I've cried all three times I've seen Metallica do One, because One is a song that just makes me cry anyway. I think it's an incredibly emotional song. Music doesn't have to elicit particular responses from people in order to be a great experience. And I guess where I'm going with this is, it's incredible to have these emotional moments with bands and with songs and what have you. I think ultimately what Def Leppard's raison d'etre is we're going to make sure you have an incredible amount of fun. That is just what they're about. They're about getting up there. It goes right back to Joe's thing of not everything has to be the answer my friend is blowing in the wind. Sometimes it can be the hubcap diamond star halo. That's the entire point. You stick a human being in the middle of Bramall Lane, a football stadium, and you stick a human being on the center circle and you say to them, right, this is what we're going to play you. And you don't raise a smile. You're dead inside.
Right, so talking of raising smiles and positivity and everything, we're going to do two things. Just going to quickly read you through the review that we were talking about. I want you to tell me whether you agree with it or not, whether it misses anything, whether it's spot on. Then we're just going to talk about listeners' highlights, and then I've got one final question for you. So we're going to wrap this up in the next 10 minutes or so. So, like you said, this Guardian review gives it 3 out of 5, but essentially it gives Def Leppard 5. It gives Motley Crue 1, and then you end up with an average of 3. The headline is Def Leppard and Motley Crue from the pathetic to the sublime. It then says, on this co-headline tour, Motley Crue are crass and limp, and then shown up all and more by the triumphant power of Def Leppard's homecoming. So it then just begins with one paragraph on the Leps, which I'll read out. I'm sure this has got a mistake in it. Do you want to get rocked? Joe Elliott asks, engaging 23,000 partisan fans with a mischievous glint in his eyes. I think that's supposed to be the other way around. It's 32,000, not 23, surely.
Listeners outside the country will not know that The Guardian has a nickname, and it is the Grawniad, because The Guardian is famed for having typos in it. So I would have, if I was to guess the size of the crowd, put it this way, 23,000 is wrong. There's no doubt about that at all. I'd have guessed the crowd, I would have said around about the 30,000 mark. So therefore 32,000 makes a ton of sense. 23,000, it's a mistake.
Talking of Joe Elliott and his glint in his eye, how good did Joe just look? Joe will be the first to admit that over the decades, he's made some fashion faux pas. He looked amazing, didn't he? He looked so cool.
Yeah, just nodding along. As soon as you started saying that, I was like, I can't believe this hasn't been mentioned yet. And just such a lovely touch. Similarly, in the build-up to the gig, when he did that video with Tony Curry, who some people may or may not have seen, who is a kind of Sheffield United's greatest ever player, let's say, for the sake of argument. Joe Elliott is not someone who wears things for the sake of fashion. When I say wears things, I'm not talking about his clothes. I mean, like, certain trends. So, like, some people will deliberately pretend to be interested in football or interested in... Primarily in this country, it will be football, because that's how you're going to tap into, you know, football is so laced through the culture of this country. Joe is not that at all. It means the world to him. So when he stood on that stage and he's wearing that homage, which is also an homage to their past, because of course of the, you know, the very famous Union Jack shorts and what have you, it was a wardrobe choice. Whoever was responsible for that, they couldn't have got it more spot on.
Right then. So it says about him asking, do you want to get rocked? It's entirely rhetorical. Introducing Let's Get Rock, Def Leppard are so bone-shakingly loud that the football stadium's hospitality staff are scrambling around to source more earplugs for their flummoxed VIP guests. I'll then skip all of the Motley Crue bit. 3 days earlier, Def Leppard played an intimate warm-up gig at the city's illustrious Leadmill venue. That performance harked back to the band's early metallic edge at the forefront of the new wave of British heavy metal movement. Tonight, at the home of newly promoted Sheffield United, the approach is a stadium show masterclass packed with hits from rock's Premier League. Love and all the football metaphors there. So, Elliott is donning a red, white and black Union Jack jacket for the occasion, the colours of his beloved Blades. Hackney-born lead guitarist and honorary Yorkshireman Phil Collen permeates Animal and Promises with his crisp, electrifying licks, while Rick Allen is inspiration personified, the one-armed drummer, owing to a crash in 1984, blasts through an inexplicable solo. I love that inexplicable solo on Switch 625. Overwhelmed by the response, he leans into his stool and seems to tear up. Staring remains a quintessential rock ballad as countless smartphones light up the field. Signature song Pour Some Sugar On Me raises the volume another notch with its hook-laden, bottom-heavy rumble. Sheffield will always be Def Leppard land, Elliot declares. Having sold 100 million albums across 5 decades and now doing big streaming business, Leppard have the metrics on their side. This blockbuster homecoming confirms the band's status as Sheffield's most eminent musical export. Do you think that captures the gig?
Yeah, I think it does a pretty good job, I would suggest. But, you know, not as good a job as we've done over the course of these 4 hours or whatever long it is we've been sat here. But yeah, it absolutely does. And just to, again, just reiterate the point, it was a 3-star review. You can see in that Def Leppard are the 5-star end of it. Just, I really just want to make that point and cement what you just said there, Neil, because I think, like, say, I think as we're speaking tonight, they're performing in Gladbach and they're going on first. So Motley Crue are closing the show in Gladbach. Insanity. If I had any criticism at all, you do leave, especially given the kind of lack of encores, because of the setup of this co-headliner thing, you are left feeling ever so slightly, completely minutely shortchanged because there was so much more that Leppard could have given. They could be doing this on their own. I think that's pretty clear now from having been inside that crowd the other night. So that's the tiniest little criticism I would have of the setup. But wonderful to hear someone who doesn't have skin in the game to give such a glowing review as that.
And all the reviews that I've read are like that. They're all absolutely glowing of Def Leppard. They're all absolutely effusive. And I suppose your little grumble there, which I share as well, is the biggest backhanded compliment that we could give to Def Leppard, which is saying they finish and we're leaving wanting more because it's been so, so good. And that so, so goodness is summed up as well by people who listen to the podcast. So I was asking them again, highlights, I've identified trends, okay. Bringing on the Heartbreak came up loads. Switch 65 came up loads. Quite a few people mentioned just generally being able to listen to Diamond Star Halo songs. So there are a lot of people out there who do want to hear new Def Leppard stuff. So they got their boat floated. Fooling was mentioned. I appreciate, by the way, this sounds like I'm just going through the set list, but in a way, I think it shows you how there were lots and lots of highlights and it was consistently good across the whole set list. Hysteria was mentioned loads. Rocket was mentioned loads. Love Bites was mentioned. When Love and Hate Collide was mentioned quite a bit. Someone mentioned about that Hysteria ending and the way it goes into Sugar. Promises got loads of mentions. Take What You Want got loads of mentions. Kick got loads of mentions. So they're like the songs that really seem to stood out to people, which admittedly is most of the set list. And then from this as a non-musical side of things, again, everyone seems really like this as the dedication of this guitar to Steve, and Joe mentioned his mum and his brother being there as well. And I thought that was really good because I'm not saying you get desensitized to all of the Steve memorial stuff or, you know, the doff and the cap to him, but we're used to seeing it in a Gods of War way, or we're used to seeing it in a Switch 625 way. To actually have him placed alongside this guitar and, like, you know, the importance of like a guitar in someone's life and everything. And I thought that was like a really nice touch as well. People were really happy with all of the general Sheffieldness of it. You know, the acknowledgements, you know, the Sheffield being Def Leppard land and giving a nod to the fact where what Joe referred to, I think at some point, if not at the show, we're certainly in interviews about it being their birth town, even if they're not all from there. Now, loads of people just going on about just the sheer quality of it, the professionalism of it, the expertise of it, but not with that way that it's become sanitized. I think Def Leppard, and I'm saying this now, they are your proverbial swan, where it's all just graceful on top of the water and, you know, perfect and majestic, but underneath, bloody hell, are working hard, you know, whether that be on the stage working hard or whether it be, you know, what they do between shows and what have you. So, yeah, all of that. Loads of people mentioned Joe's voice. Loads and loads of people were like, Joe, Joe, Joe. And then this must have been British people, weather. Everyone was going on about the fact it was, but it does make a difference, doesn't it? When people talk about Don Valley now, they always talk about it being a nice day. This type of thing, it shouldn't matter, but it does matter. A nice sunny day or weekend, you know, is the cherry on the top, especially in Britain where the weather's just appalling. Loads of people mentioned what I said earlier about the people that they met, friends, new friends, all of that. The general, like, good vibe in the stadium. I never saw any of this stuff that I saw mentioned in the States about like weird like fights or whatever between Motley Crue fans and Def Leppard fans. I don't think there was any of that, and there never really was going to be that, was there? Because it's just, that's just mental. What you said, Paul, loads of people said younger fans about, you know, this age range and like sort of, you know, we're men in our 40s. I didn't see any kids there, but I saw like people like in the late teens and the 20s. Finally, someone said, Tommy not getting his knob out. Okay, so I think actually that was the gentleman we would end up with. You know who you are. Okay, so, you know, we're not all picking the same thing here. This was a great, great show. Paul, last question. We never saw each other after the show, and this is the first time we've actually spoke, that we have messaged each other. And on the night, and I'm remembering it now, but you just sent me a message and it said something along the lines of, that exceeded all my expectations. A final question to you. Why, how did it exceed your expectations?
All right. So first point that I'm minded to address there is that I have previously stated that I think Joe has sometimes struggled with his live vocal in recent years. So as per those listener comments earlier, absolutely not an issue whatsoever. He was absolutely on point across both of those shows. And given the state that particularly, I mean, I felt a bit rough the following morning. Your throat has taken days to recover from singing along.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to bring down the fourth wall too much here, but when people listen to this, there'll have been a lot of editing going on where I sound like a 12-year-old boy whose balls have just dropped, essentially.
So to think that Joe is out there and he's built to do that night after night after night is absolutely phenomenal. So that would be the first thing that came to mind. The second thing is just maybe slightly, just my personal disposition. I'm a bit of a born pessimist. One of those who's always minded to think, well, like, I'm not a doom monger or anything like that by any stretch, but someone who's just always minded to try and set his expectations low for fear of being disappointed. That's maybe the best way to frame it. So being able to walk out and everything be so utterly triumphant, and having had a day and a weekend that I just couldn't fall in any way, and everything to have been so smooth. It's what the Van Morrison song's about. When Van Morrison sings Days Like This, he is talking about every piece of the puzzle falling into place, to paraphrase. That's what happened on the Friday and on the Monday that the specific question was about. Every single piece of the puzzle fell into place, and because of where I managed to set expectations, ergo it exceeded them. If you want to just do song highlights, Promises was amazing, actually. Bringing on a Heartbreak went across absolutely brilliantly. I mean, the thing is, right, I genuinely could end up sitting here and walking again, doing yet another little run through the set list and going, yeah, that was great, that was great, that was great. So instead, what I'll do is I'll just try and explain and describe the morning. So after the gig at Sheffield, we did go to the pub after the Lead Mill on the Friday. I had to be up at 5:10 in the morning on the Tuesday after this gig at the Lead Mill, and again catch a train across down southwest London. So I was a long way from where I needed to be. And I got onto the train because the alarm went, and of course I'm hungover, I'm tired. We hadn't got to bed till 1 a.m. because Kat and I got back and had some food and what have you. And so I'd pack all my bags and I'd carry my work stuff across the town, and I'd get on the train and everything. And what I thought in the build-up was, but it's okay, I've got 2.5 hours on this train, I'll get some sleep before I go and I've got to do this work thing. And I had this buzz running through me that meant sleep was just utterly impossible. I had an adrenaline flowing through me that felt the way it feels the day after your team has won a cup final. Sorry to any people listening, teams never do. But I'm sure you'll understand what I mean when I say that. That's the impression I was left with. And it's the end of it is the way I'm going to sort of punctuate my experience of the whole thing. Just that buzz that was flowing through me, and I haven't crashed yet. I'm about to, but it's been remarkable.
So there you go. Paul, you, I, many others, whether they're in the flesh or experiencing it vicariously online or through other people's experiences, we had an amazing time, Def Leppard, in Sheffield, Def Leppard land. And Paul, I'll see you again for the same thing in about a month in Wembley.
See you there.
It's a mighty long way down rock and roll. From Portland Works to Bremer Lane, 47 years. Thank you for your support. Thank you for being our birth town. Sheffield will always be Def Leppard land. We love you so much. Thank you. Till next time!